For NPR News, I'm Charles Edwards in Atlanta.
A bipartisan commission is releasing a report tomorrow in which it asserts that the country should expect a terrorist attack using nuclear or biological weapons sometime in the next 5 years. The report suggests that the incoming administration of President-elect Barack Obama should improve the capability of the United States to counter such an attack and to prepare, if necessary, for germ warfare. The commission also is calling on the new White House to appoint a National Security Council official to coordinate exclusively U.S. intelligence and foreign policy on combating the spread of nuclear and biological weapons. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, announcing Kids Count, a state-by-state look at child well-being and juvenile justice reform, at aecf.org.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to stop by for Krannert Uncorked, a wine tasting complemented by great music on the first and third Thursday of each month. More information is at krannertcenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible by The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta, 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, I'm sorry, we're having a little trouble with our telephone system this morning, which means we cannot call out to our guests. If we can get this straightened out, we'll go ahead and do the second hour that we had planned. So in the meantime, in hour number one, we'll reach into the archives. This is a program that we first broadcast a couple of years back, in April, I believe, of 2006. So for this first hour of Focus 580, keep in mind that we'll not be taking calls. Well, it is indeed, was indeed 100 years ago that San Francisco was destroyed by a massive earthquake. The violent shaking and the fires that came after wrecked 490 blocks, killed more than 700 people, and left over 250,000 people homeless. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll look back to one of the most dramatic natural disasters in American history as we talk with Simon Winchester. He is the author of the book A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906, published by HarperCollins. Been out for a while, has done very well. He's the author of a number of very interesting books. He has been a correspondent, traveled around the world, trained at Oxford as a geologist, and has authored books including Krakatoa, about that famous volcanic eruption, The Map That Changed the World, The Professor and the Madman. He makes his home here now in the United States. Well, welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Good morning. Lovely to be here.
You've written a lot of really interesting things, and many of them do have to do, a number of them do have to do with natural history, which does reflect, at least in part, your academic training as a geologist. You write some interesting things about crack in the edge of the world, about geology, and that's something I'd like to give you the chance to talk a little bit about, because it seems to me that that geology is maybe one of the least sexy sciences that there is. I know that some people will say, well, it's just rocks, mm-hmm. right? So, and I'm sure that many geologists would be prepared to argue that it is much more than that, that it is very, very interesting for a lot of reasons and very important for a lot of reasons. So maybe that would be a place that we could start. And I can ask you such a basic question as why geology matters.
Well, it matters to me a great deal because I think it's an astonishingly romantic science. It's so elemental. It's everything I can see in this studio derives from the earth that we stand on, and consequently a geologist had to find out where it was, or whether the soils were suitable for growing it, as with the tree, you know, the wood here. Mm-hmm. So it is hugely important to us. But it involved for me when I went to university to study it, and the reason let me first of all say why I went to study it, I wanted to be a sailor more than anything in the world. I wanted to join the Royal Navy, and I saw myself as at the age that I am now, which is 61, commanding an aircraft carrier and putting down small wars in obscure corners of our empire. But that wasn't to be, because it turned out that I was red-green colorblind. And so Her Majesty takes a rather dim view of colorblind people steering very expensive warships around the world. So I then saw a brochure about, you know, be a geologist, and it showed some brawny fellow in shorts with a hammer in some exotic part of the world. And I thought, well, that sounds rather an interesting way of getting around the world. So why don't I do that? And so I studied it, loved it, because I went when I was at Oxford, and English universities are rather good at this. They encourage their students to go off on expeditions. And I took two expeditions to East Greenland, to very remote parts of the ice cap and the Nunataks, the mountains that poke through the ice cap. And I thought, what a wonderful science. I get, you know, fresh air, climbing. I was very interested in climbing and going to places, parts of the world that you never normally would. So I then got a job and I went off to East Africa, once again, extremely romantic mountains, the Ruwenzori, which are on the Congo-Uganda border. But I just wasn't terribly good at my assigned mission in Uganda, which was looking for copper. And I didn't actually find a microgram of copper in the year I was there. And a very long story, but I got into journalism and left geology behind. But always was fascinated by landscape and did, as geologists uniquely do, wonder where the landscape came from. I mean, why is there this escarpment? Why does that hill exist? Why, you know, this river valley chooses that place to be and not this place? Why there are volcanoes on this island? Why there are no volcanoes in Chicago? All of these questions sort of were somehow submerged at the back of my mind. And then, once again, another long story, which we don't have time to talk about, I did write a book on geology 4 years ago, The Map That Changed the World, and it sold extraordinarily well. And this convinced me that your argument, and which is the conventional argument, which is rocks for jocks, is really, really dull, wasn't true at all. That if you can convey your fascination about a science like geology, there are people out there who are very willing to accept it. They accepted it with Krakatoa. And to judge by the sales figures, yes, this is about a disaster and people like catastrophes. But it is also about the Gaia theory. It's about the world as a, you know, what is it in geological terms, and people seem to like it.
Yeah.
So well, I deny your thesis.
I expected you would. Well, there's certainly something very compelling about cataclysmic natural events. You talk about Krakatoa or the eruption of Vesuvius or something like the earthquake in San Francisco. Or so there was a very interesting and fairly successful book, I think, written a number of years back about the hurricane that destroyed Galveston, Texas, mm-hmm. which was also a very significant natural disaster in American history. So those sorts of things, I mean, we know that there is a certain fascination.
I should tell you before you that there's a new word, which I learned yesterday, a hypercane. And a hypercane is even bigger than a hurricane. And they occurred, apparently, during the early Eocene, after a huge meteorite impact off Baltimore. Well, Baltimore didn't exist in the Eocene, mm-hmm. of course. But after this incredible event, there was a huge climatic disturbance which produced hypercanes. I'm so sorry. Back to Galveston.
Well, it's now someone suggesting that we may well be entering to, I know, we in the media love sensational, entering into a new era of hypercanes. And no one's arguing, that the hurricanes that we experienced last summer here would qualify?
No. I think they would be trivial rainstorms compared to a geological time-based entity called a hypercane. I mean, these have got sort of 1,000-mile-an-hour winds, and it's like living under the Niagara Falls in terms of rainfall. These are incredible, so the geological record indicates. Mm. But we'll get Sebastian Junger onto that.
The perfect hurricane. I can see it. I can see it now. This, well, that, though, I think gives me an opportunity to ask about another sort of, ask you to talk about another point that you do deal with in Crack at the Edge of the World, and that is how now, to a greater and greater extent, people in geology are coming to appreciate the fact that everything is connected. The Earth is one system, and there you don't really – it's very difficult to talk about, to think about discrete events, the fact that something happens at one place, that there are no connections, that it doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the world. In fact, that things just don't work that way. Everything is connected.
Yes. I mean, there's both – this is a very interesting argument. On the one level, there is James Lovelock's theory, the Gaia theory, which sees the whole planet as a living entity, and everything in it affects everything else, and we should treat it, the Earth, as this. His theory, which is – well, it was initially a hypothesis, and now it's got sufficient scientific basis to actually call it a theory. I mean, James Lovelock is still regarded as a somewhat amiable crackpot over in England. He's just produced another book. I think he's 75 years old, and you can see he's like a sort of angry fellow waving his walking stick in the air and saying, no, believe me, believe me. Leaving the Gaia theory aside, though, there is this new field of geophysics and seismology called trigger seismology, which suggests that certain periods in world history have an awful lot of earthquakes and volcanic activity that seems somehow to be interrelated, even those events may be occurring thousands of miles apart. I mean, a good example is now. We're living in a period, it seems statistically, where there are more seismic and volcanological events than there have been for a long time. It all began with the big earthquake, I wonder if you remember it, on Boxing Day, or the 26th of December 2003, in western Iran, when the city of Bam, a brick-built city, very old, was essentially destroyed by a magnitude 8. I think it was a big, big earthquake. Almost exactly a year later, to the hour, 26th of December 2004, you had the big rupture under Banda Aceh, which produced this huge, huge tsunami, which killed, now we know, 275,000 people. Well, between those two events, there were an awful lot of very big earthquakes, less reported, all around the world. There was China, New Zealand, Mount St. Helens was erupting. All sorts of things were going on, and it's still going on. I mean, we had Kashmir 7 months ago, major, major disaster there. We've last week, Merapi, which is one of the big volcanoes in Java, was erupting. There's a big volcano at the moment erupting in southern Peru. So it seems as if that event in Bam triggered all the plates, all the tectonic plates in the world to suddenly start jostling about. And anyone living on a plate boundary, like the people in Kashmir or the people in Banda Aceh or in Sumatra and Java or in Peru, are in for a troublesome time, as if the world is like a great big brass bell that's been hit by a clapper and vibrates for a year or so. Almost exactly the same thing was happening back in 1906. I mean, if we think of 06, we think of San Francisco. But in fact, 05, we're talking about 1905, big earthquake in Kashmir. January, earthquake on the Ecuador-Colombian border, then St. Lucia, then the Caucasus, then 7,000 killed in what was then Formosa, then Vesuvius begins erupting, then San Francisco's earthquake. And if that wasn't enough, 22,000 people died in Valparaiso in Chile when that was destroyed. So that too seems a time when the interconnected world that you're speaking of seemed very dramatically evident.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you say, people in San Francisco live on a plate boundary. People there, and in California, because you know there periodically is seismic activity there. One of the big questions people ask is, well, when is the next major quake? Could we expect to see something like the one that hit 100 years ago in San Francisco happen again? And on the one hand, people say, well, yes, yeah, sooner or later, yes. I mean, the odds say. Just as for us in this part of the country, the odds say New Madrid, one of these days, something's going to happen. But at the same time, people who are in the seismology business say it's very difficult to make predictions. I could tell you maybe the odds are of a major quake are good for sometime in the next 100 years, but I can't tell you that's going to be next week. What is anybody thinking about? Let's say look at this major seismic zone in California. What does anybody now think about the possibility that sometime, I don't know, the next 5 years, 10 years, maybe, that there would be a major quake again?
Well, you're right. I mean, it's difficult to – I mean, prediction is the holy grail of seismology and has been essentially since it was invented in 1906 as a direct response to the San Francisco event. The field that can tell us or has the potential to tell us is paleoseismology, looking at evidence of old earthquakes. And you dig trenches across active faults and you – because earthquakes produce slippage of soils – you can find evidence of when earthquakes happened before. We know from anecdotal human evidence that there were earthquakes in San Francisco in 1887 and 1866. So when the earthquake of 1906 happened, there old-timers would have remembered that there were two prior to that. Mm-hmm. But no one would have said, oh, San Francisco is an earthquake-prone part of the world. We know it is now. Let's have an examination of how often earthquakes have happened. So you dig trenches across the San Andreas Fault and the paleoseismologists look, and they find out that earthquakes happen in San Francisco on that fault about once every 150 years. That means that there hasn't been a rupture on the San Andreas Fault since 1906. The 1989 earthquake, the Loma Prieta earthquake, happened on an adjoining fault. It didn't release the pressure on the San Andreas. The Pacific Plate, I don't want to get too technical about this, has been moving northwards at an inch and a half. It's impossible to stop it every single year since 1906, meaning that 150 inches of accumulated strain is now acting on the San Andreas Fault, waiting to rupture. So it ruptures every 150 years. It hasn't ruptured for 100 years. That would suggest that within the next 50 years, which is in perhaps both of our – well, not mine. I'll be 101, so it's unlikely. But within many people's lifetimes, there'll be another one. On the Hayward Fault, which is on the other side of San Francisco Bay, underlying Oakland, underlying Berkeley, underlying Richmond, all cities with very substandard housing in terms of earthquake preparedness – they say now, the U.S. Geological Survey, there's a 65% probability of a major rupture on that fault leading to an earthquake of magnitude 6 or above, which would devastate those cities between now and 2025. And that is quite soon. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is very soon. So those two predictions, that's as close as they can get. I mean, it's not good enough. But, you know, I was talking in a store on Market Street in San Francisco a few weeks ago. And there was an envelope on the table, which I thought for a brief moment was the store owner had given me a check, and that proved not to be the case. It was an anonymous letter from someone who said, why don't you people, you seismologists and you authors, just go away and leave us alone? Life in Northern California is so good. I sit on my deck each evening watching the sun slide down into the Pacific Ocean, and I open a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc, and I think, life is really good. I don't want to know about earthquakes. Well, pal, I'm sorry. When an earthquake happens, Sauvignon Blanc is not going to do the trick.
I guess this morning is Simon Winchester. His most recent book is A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. It's HarperCollins, the publisher. Questions are welcome, too. We have someone here standing by, ready to go. The caller here is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Dr. Winchester.
Good morning. I wish I were a doctor.
It's honorary. We'll make it honorary.
Well, Champaign-Urbana is title town, so everybody has to have one.
Super.
I hesitate to interrupt a serious geological survey with a political question, but why is it that San Francisco 100 years ago, in your opinion, was able to rebuild at a much faster rate than New Orleans is today after Katrina? This is just astonishing to me. And I'll ring off and listen to your answer. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Well, one of the reasons, I think, is the extraordinary efficiency of the relief operation. I mean, compared to the shambles that happened or didn't happen after Katrina, the entire country mobilized itself brilliantly after 1906. I mean, within 2 hours of the event, federal troops, quite illegally, it has to be said, but no one worried about the legal niceties then, were marching through the ruins of the city, presenting themselves to the mayor of San Francisco and saying, you know, what can we do? And he ordered them, admittedly also illegally, to shoot looters on sight, and that was reckoned retrospectively to be a monstrous thing to do, but it did stop looting, and so civil order was restored. And the federal government, when it became aware, and it did, the earthquake happened at 12 minutes past 5 in the morning, the first telegram alerting Washington to what had happened went out at about 11 o'clock, that's 2 o'clock in the afternoon in D.C. It was received by Teddy Roosevelt and his Secretary of War, William Taft, and they said, you know, one of our greatest cities has been hurt and it needs help. Congress was made to assemble at 4 o'clock the next morning, passed all the enabling legislation for the money that was going to be required. That evening, the same evening as the earthquake happened, I think it was 5 relief trains left army bases in the east, starting pounding their way towards the Rockies. The first relief train actually arrived from Los Angeles, but on federal orders at 11 o'clock on the night of the earthquake, bringing tents and blankets and things. Within a week, 10 days actually, every single tent that was in the possession of the American army was pitched in San Francisco, providing housing for the 225,000 homeless people. Within 2 weeks, 1 in 10 of the entire American standing army was on duty in San Francisco. And you had little things like the postmaster of San Francisco issuing an order, once again, illegally, but no one was looking over their shoulder to see what the lawyers were saying about this, issuing an order saying any letter or card posted into the San Francisco postal system but not bearing a stamp, and which clearly comes from the hand of a victim, shall not pass undelivered for want of fee. So big and small events were taking place to help the city get back onto its feet. And then the big commercial interest, Southern Pacific Railroad and so forth, they were presented with a rebuilding plan by a man, Daniel Burnham, who had essentially rebuilt Chicago after the Great Fire. And this called for vast, really wide boulevards and lakes and ornamental fountains and Grecian statuary. And they said, no, no, we don't want any of this sort of frippery. Let's just rebuild San Francisco quickly along the original lot lines and get businesses starting again. And so within 4 months, there was a temporary telephone exchange. The letters were TE 5-1-2-3-4 and so on. So that was back in operation. And although people were living in economically straitened circumstances for the next year or so, businesses were back, the city was functioning properly within months, and the recovery of San Francisco is one of the great stories of American can-do energy, brio, and spirit that's ever happened.
It does, though. You raise, I think, an interesting question in the book at the same time, that question being, what would San Francisco be like today if the earthquake had not occurred? San Francisco was the leading city of the American West before the quake, and while it's now an important city, it's not Los Angeles. Would, if it had not been destroyed in 1906, would what would San Francisco be like today, do you think?
I think it would be rather like Washington, D.C. It would be a city of, I mean, obviously a spectacular city setting on this beautiful peninsula, south of the Golden Gate entrance to this wonderful bay surrounded by all these hills and this lovely real estate. But the city itself, which I think is a bit of a dog's breakfast today, I mean, it's not an attractive city architecturally, apart from one or two rather nice sort of faux Victorian terraces. It would have looked very noble, very grand. I mean, it was, after all, the imperial city. It was the city that projected American power across the Pacific Ocean. And it was in the early part of the 20th century going to be designed, and Daniel Burnham gave his services free of charge to plan this city because he wanted it to be wonderful. And the commercial interests after the earthquake said, no, forget wonderful, let's just do practical. And so it became a practical city. But, as your question implies, because of the existence of the San Andreas Fault and because it was a city that was going to get knocked down time and time again by earthquakes, and people came to realize that, it lost its position as the primary city in California. And Los Angeles, although occasionally earthquake-prone, is simply not as seismically vulnerable. And for that and for many other reasons, Los Angeles took over as the major city.
Let's talk with someone in Indiana, line number 4. Hello. Yes, caller there, line four.
Hello?
Yes, hi, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
A new phone, and it looks right side up and upside down at the same time. I must say it was a marvelous description that your guest just gave. His writing skills are incredible. I'd like to know if you can give any sort of general statement about how they do the probabilities for saying that within the next 50 years we have a 65% that there's going to be a major earthquake here or wherever. What kind of data do they group together, and are they using high-powered computers and algorithms, or is this sort of a seat of the pants thing that seismologists do? But I know with necessary mathematics, but just how does that go about? Thanks a lot.
It's two things, really. It is looking at previous earthquake records to see how often they happen, and it's looking on a strike-slip fault. They can't do this with subduction zone faults, which are much more difficult to quantify, but a strike-slip fault, one that where the two plates slip past each other, like two cars too closely parked rubbing alongside each other in a parking lot, they know the rate at which one car is moving past another. I don't think I can keep this metaphor up for very long. But in the case of the San Andreas and in the case of the Hayward, they know that the western side of the fault is moving at an inch and a half a year. Well, if nothing's happened on that fault for 100 years, you know there's 150 inches of accumulated strain. And going back to the car metaphor, if this car, the brakes are rusted solid, but the car is on a slope which increases, there will come a point at which the weight of the car overcomes the rust on the brake pad and the car moves forward. That's essentially what's likely to happen uniquely with the San Andreas and the Hayward faults. They're both stuck, they're welded shut or they're rusted shut until the strain underneath them becomes too great and overcomes this resistance. Well, it seems in the case of the San Andreas fault to overcome the resistance about once every 150 years. 100 years has gone past, so the likelihood is that sometime within the next 50 or 60 years, it'll overcome what by then will be 200 inches of accumulated strain. And to give you an example, in the 1906 event, the greatest recorded movement of the Earth was 21.5 feet. That meant there was 21.5 feet of accumulated strain under that, which is a huge amount. I mean, trillions of tons of pressure bearing down on this poor little fault. So using that, the amount of strain, and looking at previous earthquakes and getting a record of when they've happened before, it's not a complicated algorithm. It's simple, arithmetic. And it's why the figure is so vague. But it's becoming less vague as they refine their methods. So they'll be able to say, I mean, that's a pretty good prediction, a 65% probability of a major earthquake, magnitude six or above, between now and 2025. That's a lot better than they could say 50 years ago.
Mm. Let's continue. We'll talk with someone in Belgium, nearby community here, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Recently I saw a lot of pictures that were taken by many, many different people in the San Francisco area immediately after the earthquake. And they showed people moving, and these people all moved up into the area of Golden Gate Park and the area between the park and the Presidio, where there was ground. There weren't any people there at that time. There weren't any buildings and stuff. So people had some place to go. Well, given the problems we've had last fall and the number of people that are there now, we're going to have a serious problem. You know, that nobody's even thought about how to move that many people to some place that might be safe when every place is already covered with buildings.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are many things to say. The first, I'd like to just toss this into the discussion, that the earthquake happened at a time when all of a sudden everyone had cameras. I mean, the cheap Kodak camera was available. And so people retrieved them from the ruins, or maybe their houses weren't ruined, and started taking photographs. And then a matter of 4 or 5 hours after the event itself happened, these people who had been terrified by the event, their mood, according to William James, the great psychiatrist who came up from Stanford to study how people reacted to this earthquake, their mood moved from terror to awe. They were struck. They were literally awestruck. And so they said, we've got to take photographs of this because we're unlikely to see an event like this ever in our lifetimes. And so women were encouraged, particularly women, to put on pretty bonnets and dresses and things if they could find them and stand, much as they might stand in front of, you know, Half Dome or El Capitan or Old Faithful, with the city behind them burning and buildings collapsing, but with broad smiles on their faces as if to say, here we are as tourists, amazed at this event which is going to dominate the rest of our lives. But the caller is absolutely right. I mean, they moved to places. The west of San Francisco was all sand dunes at the time, or open parkland, or, as you say, an almost empty army base at the Presidio. Nowadays, not only is there nobody nowhere to run, but everyone drives cars, and so you'd be going by car. And much like New Orleans, the roads would be congested if, of course, they still stood. And in the event of a magnitude 8 earthquake, the Bay Bridge, which takes 350,000 cars a day, would almost certainly come down. So there they are, pinned in the city. It's a major, major problem. They could only go south. I doubt if the Golden Gate would be open to traffic, although it would survive an 8. They've done modelling on it. So that would survive, but the Bay Bridge would not. So they'd have to move south. But, I mean, the roads are 101 or 280. They'd be hopelessly congested. And the first area where they could run to, where there wouldn't be collapsed buildings and devastation, would be, you know, down in Palo Alto or Menlo Park, where, ironically, the U.S. Geological Survey is. So they cited themselves sensibly.
Isn't that interesting? Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. As I understand it, the thing that in the San Francisco quake, the 1906 quake, really caused the most devastation was not the quake itself, not the damage from the quake, but was the rupture of gas lines, which started fires, and then the rupture of water lines, which made it impossible to get any water to fight the fire. So perhaps if that had not, the destruction probably would have not have been as great if those things hadn't happened. If you look at that kind of those aspects of the city infrastructure today, if there was a major quake in San Francisco, would they have the same problems?
No, they wouldn't. I think they've learned a great deal from 1906 in terms of fire protection. Mm-hmm. The water mains are flexible. They're not built of heavy cast iron pipes, which they were in the old days. There's plenty of reservoir water. You are surrounded by the sea, and there are now systems which would bring seawater rapidly into the system to put out fires. I should say, though, and I think it's an important point, for many years there was an attempt by people like, the major commercial interests in San Francisco to downplay the influence of the earthquake and say this was the fire. This was the great San Francisco fire of 1906, and the earthquake was just some trivial event. The reason for this is, of course, a fire can be controlled by man, whereas an earthquake cannot. And to put it about that San Francisco was vulnerable to fire is acceptable because we can improve that situation. To have the word out in the streets that San Francisco was liable to be knocked down again by an earthquake, which is uncontrollable, would give people the heebie-jeebies, would say, well, we can't go and invest in San Francisco. And so for 20 or so years, until the 1930s, it was generally put out that San Francisco had suffered a fire. But the geologists were, of course, furious, saying, this is nonsense. I mean, what caused the fire? The ultimate cause of this event was an earthquake. Now everyone realizes, but for, as I say, 20 years, a very good example of public relations and political spin was applied. And thank heavens now the truth can be told. It was an earthquake.
Our guest this morning, Simon Winchester. Again, if you'd like to read the book, The Story of the Quake, his book is A Crack in the Edge of the World, and it's published by HarperCollins. Someone here on a cell phone calling from Rantoul, not too far away. Line 2. Hello.
Hi, David. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Another fascinating program. You stole my thunder a little bit, but that's okay. I'll go ahead and ask my question and ring off and listen. About a week, maybe 2 weeks ago, there was a fascinating program on PBS, American Experience, basically on the anniversary of the quake. And it did include a lot of file footage of the city from 100 years ago. And this kind of dovetails into what you're talking about, albeit somewhat redundant. But they kind of inferred that, again, with the fire, a lot of the problems, they followed back into the corrupt government, the mayor at the time and his government and the building inspectors, which really exacerbated the problem the fire did even after the quake. In other words, you know, the building inspectors didn't inspect the buildings correctly or, again, tried to cover up the fire. And I just was wondering if your guest had any historical perspective as to the government and what role it played at the time of the quake. And I'll go ahead and hang up. Thanks.
All right.
Yes, I mean, the government of San Francisco was monstrously corrupt at the time. The mayor, this man called Eugene Schmitz, was a violinist in a city jazz band, essentially the stooge of this extremely corrupt, and he went to prison for it, man called Abraham Roof, R-U-E-F. Everyone took backhanders. Everything was done sloppily. And this did manifest itself in the buildings which existed in San Francisco at the time. Because it had been decreed by Washington that San Francisco should be, as I mentioned before, the imperial capital, not only was it the biggest capital on the West Coast, but it now had this new role. The Great White Fleet was there. It was America's westward power across the Pacific Ocean to the Philippines, of course, which was a colony, would be projected from San Francisco. So it was thought necessary to have San Francisco look like an imperial city. It had up to that point, up to 1890 or so, been essentially a city of gold rush people. It was full of, you know, hastily built structures, shoddily built. There were a lot of cheap hotels, flop houses, restaurants, brothels, hundreds of brothels. Huge hotel called the Hotel Nymphomania. Had 1,000 rooms. Room service, whole new meaning, I think. Unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned anyway, unfortunately, it was destroyed in the earthquake. But then on top of this come about 1900, because of the whole imperial capital idea, suddenly it was decided to build grand buildings. And so huge, very ostentatious buildings with lots of marble pilasters and caryatids and lots of, you know, acanthus leaves and all that sort of stuff, which suggests Washington or New York or Chicago, was very hastily put up, hastily and badly put up. And a classic example is City Hall, San Francisco. Cost $26 million in those days, which was a huge amount of money. Most of it was kicked back to city officials. And although it did have a sort of aura of grandeur, behind the grandeur was, you know, bad sand in the cement and bricks which should have been put where ironwork, you know, were put where ironwork should have been. And the result was City Hall came down in about 20 seconds. So the buildings were especially vulnerable because, as the caller rightly says, of the corruption of the city officials who were behind the buildings.
Let's go on. We'll talk with someone in Robinson, Illinois. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning, Simon.
Good morning.
This is your correspondent from Robinson, Illinois.
I know you only too well. The most, I've had so many letters from you, and they're all so helpful, so may I thank you.
I was curious. You mentioned earlier the temporary exchange. Have you done more research to find out if, in fact, San Francisco had dial phones at that time?
Well, it certainly didn't have touch tone.
No.
I don't know. This is the sort of thing I cannot tell you about, David, the exchanges I've had with this wonderful man. The letters are so informative. He does the most scrupulous research. I wish I'd known you when I was writing the book. You, sir, will find out whether they had dial tone and dial telephones. I suspect they didn't. I think you had to pick up the phone and ask for temporary 1234. But if you find out, please let me know.
I'll look into it a little further. The occasion of the call is at a flea market last weekend. I came across a copy of the sheet music "Hello Central, Give Me Heaven," which I mentioned in one letter to you, which shows the girls at the telephone exchange plugging in their rubberized lines. Thank you.
I don't think you can dial heaven, or couldn't in those days.
No.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for the call. Let's continue. We have someone up next in Eureka, line 3. Hello.
Hello. Enjoyed your talk on Book TV on Krakatoa and the one on this present book. This is outside of the scope, but I'm wondering if you've ever studied the New Madrid Fault, and what are your beliefs that that may erupt soon, or any comments on it? I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
No. Well, yes, and I write quite a lot about New Madrid in the book. When I went to San Francisco to do the research, I decided that I would drive my car from where I live in New York or Massachusetts across the country through places that were geologically relevant to the story. So I first went to Charleston, where there was a big earthquake in 1887, I think, and then to New Madrid, where there was the big 1811-1812 series, then to a place called Mears, Oklahoma, just by Fort Sill, which has an unusual fault and a lot of seismic activity, then on to the meteor crater in northern Arizona, and then to the southern end of the San Andreas Fault, and then turned right and followed it up to San Francisco, where I then stayed for 4 months, and then went up to Alaska, where I got a speeding ticket in the Yukon, which was unusual, and then turned around after looking there and went to Yellowstone, which is geologically connected, oddly enough, and then drove back to New York. But New Madrid, I lingered at quite a long time. They have a wonderful museum there, and I saw lots of geologists and have talked to a lot subsequently, and indeed was talking to a chap yesterday who specializes in New Madrid at the USGS in Reston, Virginia. And he had said something very interesting, which is that, of course, back in 1811, although it was a very dramatic series of earthquakes, there were virtually no population to be injured. But nowadays, of course, were there to be another one, and there are always micro-earthquakes in New Madrid, there will one day be another major rupture there. There's Memphis, not too far away. There's Cincinnati. There's St. Louis. To each of those three cities, 5 years ago, the USGS went along and told them that they were at risk. And no one 5 years ago in the administration of those three cities wanted to know. 2 months ago, when the same USGS person went and gave lectures, he was mobbed by people saying, "Are we in danger?" And the point is, they are. And people in Memphis, Cincinnati, and St. Louis should look carefully at the structures of their buildings, because when New Madrid goes, that also will be a very big one.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Simon Winchester, he has written a number of books on a range of subjects. He's written about the eruption of Krakatoa, the book that we've talked about here that's about the San Francisco earthquake. He's also written about the creation of the Oxford English Dictionary. He's written about the politics of the Balkans, a lot of different things. Questions here, welcome. We have about 10 minutes, a little bit less actually, left, and several callers, and we will continue to talk with people who are listening. Going next to someone here in Urbana, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I happen to have just drove by New Madrid recently, and it's a very spooky little place, I thought. But I wanted to ask you, are you familiar with the term earth tide?
Earth tide, I'm not. No, please explain.
Oh, well, that kind of shuts out my question then. It's the theory that, or the idea that the moon and the earth, the moon and the sun together can cause.
Yes, I now know what you're talking about, and
I was just curious. So what's the current thinking about that and earthquakes? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Okay.
Well, I think the current thinking is, but maybe a caller will set me right, is that there's not much to it. I mean, the idea is that in certain conjunctions of the position of the sun and the moon, where extreme tides are caused, that this can also have an effect on the tectonic plates and cause, trigger, or allow for a larger frequency of earthquakes. I think that has been largely, it hasn't borne out. I mean, the statistics just don't suggest that it's true. It seems, therefore, to be falling into that well of other unproven things about earthquakes, like can animals predict them? And people say that snakes behave oddly. They go into holes, or in China that they appear to freeze solid. They become very frightened. And there was all this anecdotal evidence about how just before the San Francisco earthquake, horses appeared unnaturally skittish, and that cats go missing. And indeed, a California Geological Survey scientist some years ago collected thousands of lost pet advertisements from all over America. And he claimed to find that when there was a spike in the number of lost pets, there was an earthquake nearby. But no one really. I mean, those figures seem somewhat spurious. The Chinese are the only people currently, I think, doing research on whether animals can. I know this is getting away from Earth Tide, but I think it's all part of the same sort of urban mythology. Earthquakes are generally caused, and volcanoes too, by movements among the Earth's tectonic plates. That is the reason they happen, and that has nothing to do with tides, and animals don't know anything about it.
All right. Another Urbana caller here, line two. Hello.
I want to put in a comment. I've read your book on Krakatoa. I thought it was fabulous.
Well, thank you.
And I'm wondering if you can recommend a book on Alaskan seismic activity. I'm going to be visiting there later this year. And if you've read one you found was particularly informative on plate tectonics and volcanism in Alaska, I'd appreciate your passing the title on.
Well, I'll do either a terrible disfavor to him or not, I don't know. The big expert is a USGS man called Peter Hussler, and it's spelt in a peculiar way. I'll spell it very approximately. I think it's H-A-E-S-S-L-E-R, but I think there's a U in there somewhere as well. But if you go to the USGS website and find your way to the Anchorage office and find Peter's name, he has come up with some fascinating new studies of the seismicity of Alaska, which is, of course, very extreme because that's where America's biggest ever earthquake was, which was on Good Friday 1964, a magnitude 9.2 earthquake, which did terrible damage to Anchorage and also produced one really spectacular tsunami, which came in and all but destroyed the port of Valdez, which, as you know now, is at the southern end of the Alyeska pipeline. It on its way in to the bay at the head of which sits Valdez, it destroyed a Texaco oil terminal, and it therefore the wave that was coming in up the sound was covered with oil, which caught fire. And so a tsunami is bad enough, but a burning tsunami is a sort of an image of a true apocalyptic image.
Sure is. Anyway,
Peter Hussler, who has recently discovered a new tectonic plate off Alaska called the Resurrection Plate, knows all about it. His papers, sure, there are a lot of them are very technical, but he has written monographs about the seismicity along the Denali Fault, which is the major fault which dominates life in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And through him, you can find out, I don't think there are any truly popular books, but his books are thoroughly accessible, and I would recommend anything he writes. He's a great, great man.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's talk with someone in Decatur. This is line four. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Actually, you answered the question that I had called about, namely the connection between earth tides and the frequency of earthquakes. So,
yes, I think it's a somewhat spurious connection, and people are still working on it.
I only want to give my own personal experience, which is that I remember two occasions. One was the date of the Anchorage earthquake that you just mentioned, and then there was another one, a lesser one, but it killed about 50 to 100 people in Los Angeles area in the early 70s. And I know from personal experience that both of those earthquakes did occur when there was a full moon out. There was a high tides.
I'm just trying to remember what the state of the moon was in the 1906 earthquake. I don't think the skies were moonlit, and they were clear until the Saturday when it began to rain. I think if there was a full moon, people would have mentioned it. I think there wasn't. I think they were moonless nights. So there's an earthquake where the moon appeared not to be a factor.
Okay. Well, I mean, as I understand this theory, it's not. They're not saying that earthquake must occur only when there's a full moon or new moon, but just that the likelihood might be somewhat greater. So, I mean, you have to do a statistical analysis of the occurrence of many earthquakes and see how many, what the frequency was with respect to phase of the moon.
Well, I think my feeling is, but as I was saying, another call may come in rubbishing what I've said, but I think the statistics don't bear out a connection.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's what I figured, because I know that when I first heard about this this theory, it was shortly afterwards that it was debunked by reputable geologists.
Yes, well, still some people in some corners of the country, I dare say, hunker down when the moon is full.
Oh, I didn't know there were that many people who took it seriously. Okay, well, thank you.
Well, thank you. For the call. We are just about at the point where we're going to have to finish. I'm curious, again, having mentioned all the different things that you've written about, if there's something that you're working on right now. You have a current project going?
I do, and actually tonight's talk is the last talk I shall ever give, I believe, about the San Francisco earthquake. I had a very busy week last week, and the book was published in October, so I had a lot of waffling and bloviating to do back in October. So this is a second bite at the cherry, if you like. Anyway, tonight is the last talk, and I think it's wonderfully appropriate because I'm being hosted by the Illinois Geological Survey, which I had no idea what a wonderful, wonderful building they operate out of. Or at least they've got seven buildings, but the principal building is just superb, built by WA people in the 1930s. It's just magnificent. Anyway, that all fades into my personal history after tonight, and I'm in the middle of a research into a book about China, which will be published in 2008, which is peaking Olympic year, so one hopes that people will be moderately interested in China. And specifically, it's about a very eccentric and wonderful English academic called Joseph Needham, who devoted his life from 1937 onwards, when he fell in love with a Chinese woman, to basically working out what makes China, China. He was a biochemist, but he'd abandoned biochemistry to study the history of science and technology and how everything from an abacus to a zoetrope, whatever a zoetrope is, was invented first by the Chinese. And yet why, having been so smart for so long, they never had an industrial revolution, they never embraced capitalism, and for so long they were so poor and backward. That's the Chinese enigma. So I'm writing about the Chinese enigma and Joseph Needham's attempt to answer it.
Very good. Well, if we're all still around in 2008, we'll talk about that. That sounds fascinating.
Thank you. I'd love to come back.
Well, if you'd like to read Simon's books, you can certainly head to the library or the bookstore. The most recent is this book, A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. HarperCollins is the publisher. And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. We first broadcast this show in April of 2006 with Simon Winchester. And we did, in fact, talk about that book that he mentions just there at the end of the interview, The Man Who Loved China, The Fantastic Story of the Eccentric Scientist Who Unlocked Mysteries of the Middle Kingdom. And if you'd like to hear that interview, you can find it on our website. That's Will, W-I-L-L, will.illinois.edu. Our program, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois on the web at tnol.com. Well, we weren't able to do the scheduled program we had for the first hour. We're having a little problem with our phone system. We got that straightened out, and we'll be back on track here for hour number two. We'll be talking with Kenneth Sewell. He is a veteran of the submarine service, and we'll be talking about a story from the Cold War that concerns the loss of an American nuclear submarine that he says was actually torpedoed by the Soviets, the Scorpion. More on that in hour number two. First, though, we'll take our usual break for markets and news, so stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at midday there is actually quite a bit of red on my screen, except for a couple of nearby corn contracts and one far out January 2010 soybean contract. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars in Kansas City. December wheat now at 535 and a half, down a quarter. March 553, down one. December wheat at the Board of Trade 509, down three quarters. March 527 and a half, down a half. May 541, down three quarters. July 553 and three quarters, down one. December corn, 333 and a quarter, up a half. March, 349, up a quarter. May, 360, unchanged. July, 370 and three quarters, unchanged. September, 381 and a half, unchanged. December, 396 and a quarter, unchanged. January beans, 842 and three quarters, down three and a quarter. March, 850, down four and a quarter. May, 8.59 and a quarter, down 4.5. July, 8.66 and a quarter, down 6 and a quarter. August, 8.66 and 3 quarters, down 7 and 3 quarters. September, 8.73, down 1 and 3 quarters. November of 2009, 8.73 and a quarter, down 2 and 1 half. And January.